Broadcasting from the beautiful Tenderloin in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. Yes, we are live from the Tenderloin, but we're live from the Tenderloin for the very last time. And the next time you hear from us, we will be live from the Lower Haight. So we've made so much money doing this show. We're now filthy rich.
We're moving on up.
And we're moving on up from the Tenderloin to the luxurious Lower Haight in San Francisco. So we're here with show number 9. And we're going to be talking to Mark Frauenfelder from Boing Boing Magazine and Boing Boing Blog, and the author of The World's Worst, in a matter of moments. And we've got a gang of four with us today. We've got Jeff Deal and Sherry Miller, and we've got Diana Brown back with us again. Hi, Diana.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this.
Step right up.
I am so happy to be back, and I wanted to let you guys know there's a new pioneer spirit out on the prairies of America. There's a gentleman named, Marvin Miller. He wants to pioneer a new town for the hearing impaired, for the deaf. He feels that a new town devoted to them with a completely visual society will afford them the unity and political clout he feels they need.
Where would this town be?
It's going to be in the county of McCook, South Dakota. And this is a very small town. This town has actually been in something of a financial decline for the last 70 years. And the town is very excited about this. They're hoping that the investors that this project will bring the prosperity this town has been looking for.
Now, I'd like to point out, if we were to do a podcast for this town, it would sound like this. But having said that, what do we think? Is this a good idea? I mean, it smacks of separatism.
Exactly. That's one of the arguments that's on the table, that is this good for deaf people? And they do actually have the support of the National Association for the Deaf. They plan to name this town Laurent, and that would be naming it after the gentleman that created the first American Sign Language school in America. So they have a lot of people who are in the community that are behind them. Approximately 190 families, both in the U.S. and abroad, have signed on.
I think it would be an interesting experiment, because I wonder what kind of peculiar problems they would run into that would be specific to having an entire community of deaf people. I mean, wouldn't they want to maybe have a few people there who can hear just in case of incoming missiles or something like that?
I guess they would have to rely on a visual cue. I was thinking that they would need, everywhere you would go would need to be very well lit in the evening. I mean, it's completely visual, communicating visually, so
yeah.
Lighting would be a key issue.
What would be fascinating would be if they did very well, that, if there was something about having access, better access to their other senses or some difference in perception where this community flourishes and does extraordinary things.
Well, it's one of the beliefs in many of the Native American cultures that if you've been deprived of one of your senses, the others are more acute and that you have increased gifts in other areas.
So does anybody think they should not be allowed to do this? I personally think people should be able to form whatever
exactly
weird-ass communities they want to.
Well, I assume people who can hear are allowed to live there.
right?
That's correct.
Oh, people
they're
love
welcome.
And
then,
then how does it become?
They have to use American Sign Language.
Oh.
Which apparently...
You can live there, but you have to use sign language.
Absolutely. And apparently American Sign Language is now the fifth language that people are studying in schools. So it's right up there with learning French or learning Spanish, or people are now taking to learning American Sign Language. So
that counts as a foreign language credit in college, you mean? Or?
Well, it counts as an additional language credit.
Oh, I see. Well, I don't know, but I guess the key thing there is that you are founding a town on the basis of some shared
distinction,
trait.
Some distinction, some shared distinction.
Right. Which...
Well, I want to say something here.
We can't have that.
I read a book.
Turn your mic
I
off
think
right
it,
now.
I think it was Oliver Sacks' book on the deaf, which was absolutely fascinating. Because what I learned was that deaf people are not just deaf, not just using sign language or whatever, but that there is a whole deaf culture, ways of behaving, ways of interacting, ways of socializing.
Just, such as?
I don't know. I don't remember the whole book.
Fascinating.
Read the damn book.
But it'd be the same as if you went and studied some little culture.
Well, I know one of the things that they do that's really peculiar is that they really use their hands when they speak.
It's weird.
It's fucking weird,
they're
man.
They're not just like, you know, sweating flies.
So anyway,
freaks me out. I'm on the
so
bus,
anyway, the
like,
people, they're not just making a town based on one physical trait that you can see. They have a way of life and a way of doing things that we don't understand.
I bet they have crazy sex. Because, you know, they got to have like stop in the middle of it.
Do you have crazy sex?
Well, I don't
Did
have deaf
ever,
sex, but...
Huh? How
yeah.
do you know?
A friend
How
of mine,
do we know?
A
friend of mine's an interpreter, and one of the things she found working within the deaf community was that they love this particular community that she was working with, adored listening to music with heavy bass because they could feel it. So it was a completely different musical experience for them. They would feel the music, so they would enjoy bands with heavy percussion. But one of the people that has signed up to be part of this town, and you guys should know there's a zoning hearing going on this week, so...
We're going down there.
Okay. All right. Are you
Wait,
will actually
it's
be
called
there?
A hearing? Isn't that a little insensitive?
All right, we're here with Mark Frauenfelder. He's the founder of Boing Boing Magazine with his wife, Carla. Is Carla there today, Mark?
No, she's at a photography class tonight, but she wanted to say hi.
All right, say hi to Carla for me and for all of us. So he was the founder of Boing Boing back when it was a magazine. And currently, besides being part of the world's biggest blog, boingboing.net, he edits Make Magazine. And his current book is The World's Worst, The Guide to the Most Disgusting, Hideous, Inept, and Dangerous People, Places, and Things on Earth. So, welcome, Mark.
Well, thanks. It's great. It's great to talk to you again, are you?
Yeah, it's been a while, man.
Yeah, it has been fun. You know what? Your magazine, High Frontiers, is the inspiration for me to start Boing Boing Magazine.
I'm sucking it up, man. Say that louder.
But when
Chew the Zarathustra heart.
In the 80s, I found a copy of High Frontiers, that pink one. Remember the huge
Yeah,
pink
the
one?
Hot pink one with the art-length letter saying kids do the darndest drugs on the cover.
Yeah. And Carla and I loved that so much. And then we met you and Allison a couple of times at some Timothy Leary events. And so that was... You know, we thought, hey, you know, people can actually just go out and make a magazine. And so we, you know, studied your magazines closely, High Frontiers and Reality Hackers, and then started Boing Boing. And without those, I don't think we ever would have gotten started.
Well, this is great news for mankind. yeah. So tell me, how do you think Boing Boing got from being the small print neurozine to the world's biggest website?
Well, I think a big reason that it got big was that we've been around for a long time. You know, Boing Boing's been online since 1995.
Right.
And we started the blog in January of 2000. So at that time, there were only a few hundred blogs at most. And, you know, there's just this thing, if you're in early enough and you start to attract an audience, it snowballs. This guy Clay Shirky did a study of blogs and something called the Power Law, where, you know, 20% of the blogs get 80% of the audience, and
right.
the other 80% get the other 20%. Maybe I'm not getting the numbers quite right there, but I think it was timing, and also the fact that we have four interesting people contributing posts on the site, and we do an awful lot of posts every day, you know, 20 to 30 things, so people know when they get there that they're going to see something new that really it makes it an attractive place to go. That's basically my theory.
Is there like a secret sauce, something that you guys got together and said, this is what we're going to do, we're going to get stuff that's really, you know, of the moment, newsy, or, you know, how did you develop the aesthetic of doing it that you think made it so attractive?
We never really got together to talk about that kind of thing. I think we all have the same idea that if we only post things that we're genuinely interested in and that we think are really interesting and neat, that there will probably be people out there that share our interests too. So we never, like, you know, I never think to myself, oh, are people going to like this if I write about it, or I need to find something that people will be interested in. I just find things that I'm personally interested in and write about them, and that seems to work. You know, I think a lot of successful magazines probably were that way, you know, like Playboy magazine and Rolling Stone. You know, Hugh Hefner and Jan Wenner were like, just wrote about the things that they were very interested in, and you probably are the same way with the books you write and the, you know, the magazine work you've done.
Yeah, basically you just go with your obsession. You guys seem to be like sort of the moment. You don't sort of run like lengthy diatribes or reflections of dim times in the past. It's right there. It's pretty much stuff that's coming up here and now, and it's got that quirky boing boing thing that you guys have had since the beginning. You like kind of weird and quirky stuff.
Yeah, I always am interested in, you know, offbeat things that happen in the world that are surprising. You know, I'm kind of a novelty junkie, and so surprising information is one of the reasons, you know, one of the great reasons for living, I think. Human beings' capacity to surprise each other is a great thing, and, you know, I'm always on the search for that.
I think that's in some ways the story behind your new book, The World's Worst, A Guide to the Most Disgusting, Hideous, Inept, and Dangerous People, Places, and Things on Earth. So Frank Zappa once said something to the effect of, the one thing we'll never run out of is human stupidity. And in that spirit, would you read the passage from your book, The Most Disgusting Behavior on a Plane?
Yeah, that was one of my favorites, and that was actually the whole impetus for writing the book. When I read this story, I kept it in the back of my mind as, you know, an example of extreme human behavior, and I thought a whole book about, you know, horrible things that people have done would be really entertaining. So I'll read it.
Right.
Most Disgusting Behavior on a Plane. In a global culture that increasingly worships the ability to make money and wield power, chief executive officers have joined the media-created celebrity firmament. Fully aware of their exalted status, many CEOs expect mere mortals to bow down before them and to satisfy any capricious whims that may strike their fancy. If the demands aren't satisfied, the resulting temper tantrum can be very ugly. How ugly? Take the case of Gerard B. Finneran. In 1995, Dinneran, the 58-year-old head of an investment banking firm, was seated in the first-class cabin on a United Airlines flight from Buenos Aires to New York. Taking advantage of the free liquor being served in that section of the plane, Dinneran proceeded to get very, very drunk. After a concerned flight attendant refused to give him another glass of wine, Dinneran took charge of the situation and began serving himself drinks from the beverage cart. When informed that it was against regulations for passengers to get their own drinks, an infuriated Dinneran told the flight attendant that he was going to, quote, bust his ass, unquote. Threatening the crew failed to achieve Finneran's desired result, so he resorted to Plan B, going berserk, terrifying passengers, knocking over crew members, and then grabbing drinks and pouring them over his body. He topped off the show with an educational demonstration of primate dominance by clambering onto the beverage cart that had been placed off-limits to him and evacuating his bowels on it, using the first-class linen napkins and his fingers to wipe his hindquarters. According to the criminal complaint filed against him, this captain of industry then proceeded to clean his fingers by walking up and down the aisle, tracking feces throughout the aircraft. In court, Finneran pleaded guilty as charged, but his legal team claimed that the entire incident was a misunderstanding. Their client, they explained, had contracted a severe case of traveler's diarrhea, but couldn't use the first-class lavatories because they had been barricaded by assistance to the president of Portugal, who was also on the flight. In this situation, they argued, what choice did Finneran have but to defecate on the beverage cart? The judge didn't buy it. Finneran was sentenced to 300 hours of community service and presented with a cleaning bill for $50,000. I promise, Your Honor, Finneran told him, you will never hear of me doing anything like this again.
That's great. I, you know, in some ways, I actually wish I had been on that flight to witness that. We're going to break for one moment, and we're going to hear some music, a Mark Frauenfelder selection. I believe it's pronounced Vahin Tuamato by Tererato and his Tahitians, and we'll be right back.
Are you serious?
So, as you were saying, and I think that's a great example, kooks produce novelty. They always They always surprise us. When we think there's nothing new in the world, we can find somebody doing something completely ridiculous, and suddenly we become interested again. And one of the great things about News of the Weird for a writer is that you don't really need to elaborate very much. They take care of it for you.
Yeah, that's true. They just kind of tell the story.
All you have to do is tell people what the story was.
Exactly. There was another one you wanted me to
read. There was another one indeed, actually. Let's talk about the world's creepiest toy maker. Now, how did you find this out about this one?
I'm trying to think how I came across this one. Well, I've always been interested in sea monkeys just because they're like one of the greatest examples of deceptive advertising ever.
Right. Right.
Sea monkeys and just the idea of these fun little monkeys swimming around, and then when you get the sea monkeys, they're just these little white specks floating around. And I think a lot of kids have been, really disappointed by them. So then I think I may have just started out, by wanting to write about the worst, most deceptive advertising. And then I found out about the creator of sea monkeys, and he turned out to be, like, even more horrible than the sea monkeys themselves. And so that was a really pleasant surprise to find out that, because I thought it made a really good entry for the book. Do you want me to read that one?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and read that one as well. Yeah.
Okay. This one is called Creepiest Toy Maker. Advertised for decades in comic books, the amazing live sea monkeys are perhaps the greatest marketing scam ever perpetrated on children, with the possible exception of another phony product, X-ray Spec. The see-through glasses are made from feathers sandwiched between pieces of cardboard with holes in them. Anyone who has ever bought a pair hoping to see under people's clothes has quickly come to the realization, this is how a sucker sees the world. An amazing live sea monkey is not a primate. It's a brine shrimp, a translucent, nearly microscopic arthropod that doesn't originate from the sea and resembles a monkey only to the degree that a paperclip resembles the International Space Station. Is it any wonder that both sea monkeys and X-ray specs were created by the same man? His name was Harold von Braunhut, and he was not only a mechanical genius with 193 patents under his belt, he was also one of the slickest hucksters in the annals of merchandising. His sea monkey brainchild was conceived in 1957 and brought to fruition in 1960. To depict the lowly brine shrimp as a jovial, pink-colored simian with a natural crown must go down as one of the world's greatest examples of false advertising. But even better than this wildly inaccurate and deceptive depiction of the creatures, however, is the copy von Braunhut wrote for the sea monkey's ubiquitous comic book advertisement. Quote, "In only 5 minutes, you will actually hatch a whole tumbling, playful, happy troop of sea monkeys that are even more fun than a zoo full of chattering, howling jungle monkeys," unquote. Von Braunhut sold millions of dollars of his, quote, "fantastic underwater buffoons," unquote, to millions of soon-to-be-disappointed children who are expecting to see the, quote, "inanimate handful of glittering crystals which contain the secret of life," transform themselves into a dancing school of frolicsome pets that love attention, unquote. If von Braunhut were guilty of nothing more than stealing children's allowances, he might be forgiven. It was, after all, a small price to pay to learn the meaning of caveat emptor through first-hand experience. Unfortunately, von Braunhut's transgressions don't end there. In the late 1980s, reports of the sea monkey inventor's ties with white supremacist groups began to surface. An Aryan Nations fundraising letter stated that the manufacturer of a self-defense weapon called the Kyoga Agent M5 was donating a portion of sales to Aryan Nation founder Richard Butler. Von Braunhut was the inventor of the weapon, which is a sort of telescoping metal whip, which he described as the weapon to buy, quote, "if you need a gun but can't get a license," unquote. When the Spokane, Washington Spokesman Review interviewed Butler, he affirmed that von Braunhut was a friend and, quote, "member of the Aryan race who has supported us quite a few years," unquote. In 1988, the Washington Post picked up the story, reporting that von Braunhut regularly attended Aryan Nations World Congress meetings, self-published an anti-Zionist newsletter, and once bought firearms for an Ohio branch of the Ku Klux Klan. A person who'd done business with von Braunhut told the paper that the inventor had once told him, quote, "Hitler wasn't a bad guy, he just received bad press," unquote. The strangest part of the incredibly strange life of this neo-Nazi sea monkey magnate is that he was Jewish. Born Harold Nathan Braunhut in Memphis on March 31, 1926. His being Jewish didn't seem to be a problem for the Aryan Nations or other white supremacist groups he gave money to. When he died on November 28, 2003, at the age of 77, von Braunhut was reportedly perfecting his next two inventions, a pet lobster and an instant frog.
Bravo. So, I mean, some other things that you found here that I was surprised about is that the breatharians still exist. I remember the breatharians back in the early 80s when their leader was this skinny black guy who was spied by some of his followers outside a 7-Eleven wolfing down some yohos or something like that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And now there's a woman, apparently, who is a breatharian. And it's a pretty tragic story. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. The guy you mentioned is named Wiley Brooks.
That's right, yeah.
And, he was caught with 7-Eleven food, exactly like you said. He's back, believe it or not, and he's got a website where he's pushing breatharianism again, but not a dietary breatharianism. It's some other kind, He's just moved the scam to another level.
He's selling breathing to people?
Yeah, something like that, breathing exercises
All
or
right.
something. But there's this woman that I wrote about. Her name is, I have to turn to the page.
Let me see, Yasmuheen.
Yeah, Yasmuheen, that's right.
Yeah.
And she's been, promulgating this breatharian diet to people for years and years, and she's from Australia, and they've been trying to, the TV stations constantly challenge her, saying, we want you to prove that you can really subsist on nothing but food. And so she finally did agree to a challenge that 60 Minutes in Australia challenged her to perform. So she was confined to a hotel room, and the 60 Minute show provided a doctor to monitor her health. And after 2 days, she, 2 days of no food or water, she doesn't even drink water, she claims.
Allegedly.
Her blood pressure shot up, she was dehydrated, the doctor said she was all stressed out, and she blamed it on the fact that the hotel was located in a city, and that the pollution from the cars was interfering with her ability to absorb energy from light and air. So they moved her to a mountain retreat. But after another 2 days, it was clear that she was really sick. Her speech slurred, and her pupils were dilated. Her pulse rate was double. So the doctor said that her kidneys were in danger of being damaged, and 60 Minutes called off the experiment. Yasmuheen was mad and said it was the show's fault for putting her in the hotel in the first place. But really, the tragic thing is that one of her followers actually did starve to death.
Right.
A 53-year-old woman, and her name was Lonnie Morris. And after 7 days into the breatharian diet, she lost the ability to speak, and she also, her arm became paralyzed. 3 days after that, she died. And after she died, the media went to Yasmuheen and asked her, what she had to say about it. And her quote was that the woman was, quote, "not coming from a place of integrity and did not have the right motivation," unquote.
And she's
pretty sad stuff.
Yes, and she's still out there operating.
Yes, she is. And you can go to her site and she sells videos and books. And, it's interesting. There's enough people out there that she can make a living doing this kind of thing.
So, this is a hysterically funny book on the whole, but there are serious elements to it, and largely about how easily people are tricked into peculiar behaviors. In some ways, there's some bad memes Some of this is coverage of bad memes, I would say.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So,
go
ahead.
It never ceases to amaze me how seemingly intelligent people can get pulled into scams and, you know, cults and tricks. And, it makes me wonder about myself, too, about what kinds of things I believe in that really probably aren't true and how much of a victim of brainwashing I am. You know, I'm sure that we all are on some level.
Yeah, I mean, we're all a collection of memes that we've picked up along the way. Is there anything, like, you say believed, like, 5 or 10 years ago that you look back on now and go, I got sold a bill of goods on that particular one?
I think 5 or 10 years ago I was pretty hardcore libertarian. As the years have gone on, I've become much less of a libertarian and much more of a traditional, you know, liberal Democrat than I was. I feel that's probably a good thing.
So I wanted to ask basically one more question about Boing Boing, the blog. And basically, are you guys like insanely in demand? And do you have like Calvin Klein's obsession and Pepsi and Microsoft clamoring to advertise and Fox offering you a TV show and people knocking on your door? And or do you at least pay yourselves a living wage? What's the relationship between Boing Boing and the possibility of exploiting this popularity?
We do have advertisers on there, and we carefully, you know, look at all the different advertisers that approach us, and we pick ones that we think, are interesting to us. And we've turned down ads before, but, you know, a lot of, like, T-shirt companies and record companies, those kinds of things we usually like.
You advertise a lot of your own stuff on there as well.
Yeah, we advertise our own things. You know, I have, like, T-shirts myself that I sell, and Shenny has a cool office furniture company, and Corey sells his or advertises his book, his science fiction novels on there. So we all, you know, plug our own stuff on there. And we make, enough money from the advertising that it's a good income supplement. We couldn't really live on that and nothing else.
But I guess I'm still curious. It's like, with you guys being declared the most popular blog, you don't have a lot of people banging on your door. I remember, like, with Mondo 2000, we had people from Hollywood calling and all that kind of stuff. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, we do have calls occasionally from people who are interested in doing TV shows.
Right.
And we don't have anything, like, seriously going on with that, but we have, you know, just slow-burning, you know, back-burner kind of things with people. TV moves so slowly.
Those things never happen.
Yeah.
This book would make a good one, actually.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. And I've actually been talking to a person here in L.A. that I know who does TV production, and another guy in New York. And they're, you know, kind of shopping it around. But like you said, stuff moves really, really slowly, and everything's like a huge long shot. And I like... That's one of the reasons I love the blog so much, is if you find something that you like, you can publish it, and in 2 seconds it's up for everyone to see.
Right. You guys
it's
just...
It's almost like...
Go ahead.
I'm almost thinking, like, who needs TV?
Right.
There's some wonderful things about it, but with the ability to have videos online and everything, I think that, you know, younger people are obviously spending a lot less time watching TV. College students are just, you know, using their computers for entertainment now, as a medium. And so maybe we don't even need to worry about television.
No, I don't think you do. Are you guys going to podcast? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, we would love to do that. It's just a matter of, you know, having the time to do it. But that's that's been so, I've experimented by doing, you know, a couple of podcasts, and I'd love to do some more because it's a really fun way to communicate with people. You know, as you know, I mean, yeah, it's really cool that you've jumped on, and your podcast has been great.
Yeah, I think a Boing Boing podcast would be a lot of fun. Anyway, thanks, Mark, for joining us today.
Yeah, it's fun talking to you.
Yeah, you too. And say hi to Carla for me.
I definitely will. Okay.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Thanks a lot, RU.
Okay. You too, Mark.
Check, check, check.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Are You Serious Show on MondoGlobo.net. We'd like to thank Mark Fraunfelder of BoingBoing.net for joining us today. The musical interlude was Bahine Taomotu by Tero Rutoa and his Tahitians. Our gang of four today was Are You Serious, Diana Brown, Sherry Miller, and me, Jeff Deal. Next week, our guest will be distinguished philosopher Richard Rorty. This has been the Are You Serious Show. Don't be afraid of the dark.